the World Soccer Talk podcast, the only podcast that focuses on watching soccer on TV, online, and apps. In episode 131, we discuss whether the US women winning the World Cup will change anything with the NWSL, equal pay, and TV rights. Soccer on US TV breaks a new record. NBC drops a bombshell with their changes to NBC Sports Gold, plus letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. My name is Christopher Harris, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kartik Krishnayar. Now, Kartik, let's dive right into the main topic, which, of course, is the U.S. women and the U.S. women's team winning the Women's World Cup, which was a really convincing performance. I was a little bit disappointed in this one in terms of, especially in the second half, once that first goal went in, the penalty kick, that Netherlands... They seem to be almost completely out of the game. It seemed to be almost too easy for the United States women's national team. I mean, they are a good team, by no doubt. But towards the end of that game, they must have had about five or six clear one-on-one chances to, get the score up to 2-0, 3-0, 4-0, 5-0. And it didn't happen. I think it was just... when they should have shot, they didn't shot. And when they dribbled, so on and so forth. But... the game itself was enjoyable, but it felt a little bit almost too easy. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I felt like, and I had this conversation after the Miami FC game with one of the staffers for Miami FC last night, which was, why is it that every side that played really good football during the tournament then played the U.S. and they didn't play the same way? Yeah. France, England... and the Netherlands. Only Spain really gave the U.S. everything they could handle. Looking back, the U.S. very easily could have been eliminated in that round of 16 tie. But after that, I think France was done. I got into a lot of trouble on Twitter for basically right after the walkout saying France is done, even at 0-0, because you could see it in their eyes. You could see it in the tentativeness of how they were playing. The England game, you could always debate Phil Neville's squad selections, Stokes over Greenwood, not having Fran Kirby, not having Stanaway, but still, it just never felt like until England absolutely had to attack all guns blazing that they got control of that match. And then the Netherlands, who had been this really good possession-oriented team with three really, really good attacking players, with maybe the best midfielder in the tournament to that point, I think got eclipsed by Rosa Lavelle in the final, didn't do any of that in the final, except for between minutes 40 and 45. Mm-hmm. So maybe 5 minutes of really good Dutch play after seeing generally 50 to 60 minutes in each match to that point, other than, again, maybe the round of 16 match against Japan. So the question, Chris, was the U.S. that good that they took everybody out of their game, or was everybody psychologically scared of the United States and didn't play their game, and the managers fell into a trap with that, being over tactical or overly negative when facing the United States? Because the Dutch set up in a couple of banks of four, or actually maybe even a four and a five, and just left one forward. And quite frankly, did not try and attack until the 40th minute.
Yeah, I think it was the latter. It just seemed to be that there was so much sense of belief and so much confidence that exuding from this U.S. Women's national team from the first game all the way through to each round, that I think it psyched out the opposition. Out of all the matches I watched that the U.S. women's national team played against, the team that I was disappointed with the most was England, because I thought England was the one team that, in terms of skill, capability-wise, could beat this U.S. team. And I was hoping that the U.S. would win the game, but still, yeah. I thought that it would be a really, really close fight. And that penalty miss, psychologically... that could have turned the game. I mean, it could have been 2-2, and then it could have been all England.
Let me ask you this, because I think there is a lot of rally around the flag in the English media during a tournament. So There was just a lot of lamenting. Oh, we were so close, etc. After that match, then within a day or two, the narrative turned. Particularly when I listened to the Guardian podcast and Jonathan Wilson really kind of break down squad selection. Obviously, he's the tactical maestro. About maybe Phil Neville was really naive. Maybe he just outthunk himself, and the squad selection was terrible for the U.S. game. And then the flip side was, and Wilson had argued that the U.S. well in control of the match, absolutely dominant in the first half, really could have put England to the sword. 2-1 was the score. It could have been, 4-5-1. Basically, then invited pressure after that. Which is possibly true, but then they didn't do it in the Dutch game. And I mentioned I thought Gronin was the best midfielder in the tournament prior to the final. Obviously, with Martens, Medema, and Berenstein up front, you had the best forward trio in the women's game or at the international level. And they did nothing against the U.S. Other than minutes 40 to 45, Chris, it doesn't even seem like they were in the game, right? They were just along. It was inevitable. Mm-hmm. Even though the penalty was a little bit, it wasn't suspect in the sense that it was the wrong call. It was the right call, but it was one of those calls that may not have been made without VAR. Mm-hmm. But it just felt like inevitably the U.S. would score and it would be over.
Yeah, and I think the Dutch had one good chance in that first half, which was, I think, Naylor came out of a box and cleared the ball. But that was it. It was kind of one person up top hoping to chase onto balls. And eventually that tactic could have worked if they hadn't had the penalty and they kept it 0-0 and there's 5 minutes to go in the game. And we know the Dutch are very good in terms of late showings in games, scoring goals. But the one thing going... looking at this tournament, which I enjoyed thoroughly, was I think Jill Ellis did a fantastic job really outsmarting the other coaches. And I think in many ways that game against Sweden, the game that was the last, essentially a dead rubber game, the last game in the first group in terms of figuring out who finished in first and second, and the U.S. went all in against a lot of people's opinions to do that. Psychologically, that had seemed to have a huge effect over the opposition in the next few rounds, where they did get psyched out, except for Spain. And Spain, if they kept on playing the game rather than to resort to those dirty tactics, I think they could have at least maybe eked out a win or got even closer. But in terms, Kartik, in terms of the actual television coverage of the Women's World Cup, the final itself.
I don't know where to start.
Yeah, I mean, I forced myself to watch the pregame match from minute one to all the way from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Eastern time. And I forced myself to do it because I wanted to immerse myself in what was happening. And just from observing and just analyzing and hopefully enjoying it. But if you had to guess from this 1 hour pregame show that was on Fox, how many minutes of analysis they gave to the players? So the players on the both of the teams talking about the analysis about a pre-match coverage for a game should be, showing you the team lineups, talking about the tactical matchups, talking about some of the things you should be looking forward to in this game, and some feature pieces, etc., talking about how great the US women are and some interesting stories, etc. But out of that 1 hour, how many minutes do you think they focused on the actual tactical analysis of these two teams?
So I didn't I didn't stay with the pregame until I watched it for the first 10 minutes and then switched to the public affairs programming, the political programming on other networks until the kickoff because it was so terrible. I'm going to say 2 minutes, Chris, based on when the lineups came out.
Well, okay, so this is an important note. So in terms of the team lineups, I didn't actually include that with team analysis. So to me, that's more, okay, we're reading off now, okay, here's who's starting on the U.S. squad, here's who's starting on the Dutch squad. And they go through this so quickly that there's really, really little analysis, if any, on this team lineup. So outside of the team lineups, how many minutes do you think they focused on just tactical
matchups? I'm going to say zero.
Well, it was 3 minutes and 10 seconds.
Okay.
Out of a 60-minute program, and that's the thing though too. I mean, we talked about this in last week's podcast too. Is that most of the time that they, as the tournament went on, most of the time that they had to focus pre-game, most of it was focused on feature pieces. So it was essentially fluff pieces. They had a few minutes about the American Outlaws, which I thought they would talk to the American Outlaws, but it was just them hanging out with the crowd, and in the background you hear the U.S. fans cheering USA and things like that. Nothing wrong with that, but it was essentially a 1 hour cheerleading session, and with nothing for the hardcore fan at all. Which I'm not surprised, in Kartik, that you didn't watch it, but I had a focus to myself through it, and I mean, it was meant for the mainstream audience. And a little bit later, we'll get into the TV ratings. The mainstream audience watched it. But I wonder how many of them were turned away, like you were, Kartik, who wanted something a little bit more, and we're not getting it in the final, and we're not getting it in a lot of the other broadcasts. But how about ESPN? Did you get a chance to watch it Sunday or Monday to see how much analysis?
Yeah, so their tournament analysis was fantastic, and continued that way after the tournament. And the thing with ESPN was that they got really tactical and analytical, and they had the time to do so. And again, I think we realized that the people that were paying attention to ESPN FC were just hardcore nerdy people. But I complained a week ago or 2 weeks ago, whenever it was, that they had maybe set aside their own a separate program for McGrath and Seb Salazar during the tournament, and maybe that should have been folded into the main ESPN program. Well, as the final approached, and then after the final, they made sure they had a segment with Salazar and McGrath and Foudy. So that was actually a good change. They built it into the larger program, which was largely about transfers, Frank Lampard and Messi. A lot of Messi the last few days on that program. But so they did then fold it into the mainstream program while keeping the other program, which as I said was much more tactical and analytical in its analysis, and a lot more also FIFA issues. Hey, the women from around the world have these issues with FIFA. And they were all over Megan Rapinoe's comments prior to the match about FIFA, which is something Fox seemingly avoided. Mm-hmm. Which, again, I mean, Fox is in a tough position on FIFA-specific issues. I just thought, because they had embraced talking about Ada Hedenberg at the beginning of the tournament and her absence for Norway, that maybe they were going to go the whole tournament talking about that stuff. Grant Wall, came in to talk about that. It seems like his role disappeared as the tournament went on because maybe they didn't want any critical reporting.
Well, I think he had a death in the family. So,
oh, okay.
So I think for the last couple of weeks he wasn't around, which is understandable.
Yeah,
But the one thing, though, too, Kartik, about this, one more thing about the Fox thing before we move on slightly, is you might have missed this too, but the halftime coverage of the Women's World Cup final, they had a movie trailer. So, I mean, Fox knows that tuning in at halftime, there's probably at least 10 million people watching it at that very moment. And they said, okay, coming up at halftime, we've got a movie trailer to show you from Disney that's Mulan and et cetera, which is interesting, too, because Disney does not own Fox Sports. When Disney acquired 21st Century Fox, actually, that's for a lot of the movie properties and stuff like that. It does not include Fox Sports. So I wonder if there was a financial deal done there, or if it was a, hey, you guys bought 21st Century Fox, can we do a deal here? Kind of, is there a way to work together here to, as a thank you, something? I don't know. That was weird, too. And yes, it didn't take up a lot of the time, but it was less time focused on analysis, which we didn't get anyway, really. But it is what it is. The interesting thing for me, too, is, okay, so you take that audience, that large audience that watched the Women's World Cup, where does that audience go to now? I mean, will they come back and start watching Major League Soccer games? Will they start watching NWSL games? Will they start watching Premier League games? Or does that audience disappear? And as we've seen, Kartik, as you know too, from major World Cups in the past, there is an audience. The increase does increase. There is a sizable increase where that audience then goes. The big question is, where does that audience gravitate to now?
Yeah, NWSL obviously now will have, as our friend Jonathan Tannenwald first reported, a number of games on ESPN networks, whether it's on ESPN News or ESPN2, for the remainder of the season. I believe it's 11 matches or 12 matches, including semifinals and finals. The one unfortunate thing about that is it is just a contract for the rest of the season. And what we saw in 2011, when the U.S. did not win the World Cup, but they got to the finals and lost to Japan in penalty kicks, was that it didn't give the kind of bump for WPS, the league at the time, that we quite thought it would. 2015, and that league went out of business. 2015, NWSL got the Orlando City MLS owners interested in the league, and they were an expansion team the next year. However, it didn't do anything else in terms of expansion, and we have seen several existing teams since then struggle. In the case of the Boston Breakers, a long-term team going all the way back to WUSA in the early 2000s, and a team that so many of the great American players have played for, they went out of business. So after the 2017 season, I don't know if NWSL gets this bump. And there seems to be and this is something that, again, maybe it's all speculative, Chris, because there's all the theories from the likes of Julie Foudy, who I think know the game as well as anyone, that U.S. players need to be playing in the Champions League, right, mm-hmm. On the continent. And Kate McGrath has kind of echoed that. However, and I've said it for a while too, however, the U.S. keeps winning these tournaments with their entire team in NWSL. And you've had players like Crystal Dunn and Carly Lloyd and Alex Morgan go to Europe. Kristen Press also went to Sweden for a season and come back and play in NWSL and be just fine. Now, you could argue when you see that, which is, you know, some of the argument from the likes of Foudy, when you see the technical ability of the Dutch team and you see the all-around skill of the English team, that there is a development of skills at an earlier age if you're playing in that level of competition versus the U.S. college system and then on to NWSL. I do see that point. But at the same time, I've kind of echoed what the Foudies of the world have said, that, you know, eventually we need our top players playing in the Champions League. That's the ultimate club women's football competition, just like it is in the men's level. However, it doesn't seem to be affecting our international performance at all.
Yep.
So the question remains, maybe NWSL is a really good league. Yes, stylistically, it's different than the Champions League. It's a much more open league. There are less, you don't see low blocks as much and teams bunker and defend. But the U.S. still were able to beat teams that did that to them in the World Cup. Now there are other people like my friend Neil Blackman, who I co-host the Yanks Are Coming podcast, who says that this 6 months Carly Lloyd spent at Manchester City, the 6 months Alex Morgan spent at Lyon, the year Crystal Dunn spent at Chelsea, even though it doesn't seem like a substantial amount of time, it was enough for them to understand how to tactically combat that. So you still need players going over, even if they're not going to leave NWSL outright, going over on loan. So but if they do, my point, I guess, is a roundabout way of saying there is a possibility NWSL will lose some of these players to Champions League clubs in Europe. And if that happens, then I don't think that it's going to have quite the knock-on effect that we hope. Now, maybe that means we get Champions League, UEFA Champions League women's football, a TV deal in the U.S. Maybe the WSL will get a TV deal in the U.S. Maybe that's what ends up happening. Just like we see a lot of fandom after men's World Cup switch to the Premier League or switch to La Liga, maybe there'll be the same sort of effect if players leave NWSL. There's just still a lot of question marks, and we'll have a better idea in about 6 months.
Yeah, and the Premier League is in discussions with the WSL in England as far as in terms of trying to figure out how to work together. And there's been talk about possibly having double headers. There could be an opportunity for the Premier League to actually acquire the WSL and then have a women's Premier League and then begin marketing that. Now, going back to the U.S., Kartik, I'll ask you the question that I asked our followers and listeners through Twitter, which is at World Soccer Talk. And the question is, do you believe the U.S. women's national team's success in winning the Women's World Cup will achieve anything? Or will it be the status quo from USSF and some in the way the women's game is run? What do you think?
They will do some very cosmetic things for the remainder of 2019 to try and alleviate the pressure that is building up from fans, from elected officials, from media commentators. Then they will revert to form by the middle of 2020, and the women's team will be somewhere in the on the back burner, as will, in many ways, the men's national team, except when the men's national team is a cash cow for Soccer United Marketing, which is connected to MLS. So I think that they will give some cosmetic lip service to get the pressure off their backs and hope in a year no one's paying attention. Mm-hmm. Now, there is still in this period of time an operations contract they're going to have to settle with NWSL. The U.S. Soccer's contract to operate that league expires at the end of 2019. And it is possible someone else may come in and want to operate that league, which if that's the case, U.S. Soccer would say that's great. However, U.S. Soccer still has to continue to subsidize the players' salaries for the top national team players who are in NWSL. Now, if they stop doing that, then this equal pay thing gets even more dramatic. However, by doing that, they are arguing that they are going above and beyond for the women's national team players, subsidizing their club salaries. That argument does not seem to be winning the day with critics. Mm-hmm. So, they might be tempted to pull back from that, but at the same time, if they pull back from that, they're going to make things much worse for themselves. So I think they're going to try some cosmetic things, increase bonuses, etc. However, their position of now citing FIFA tournament data is very interesting, Chris, given that the U.S. men's national team has virtually no impact on the FIFA revenues. None. FIFA would be making as much money off men's tournaments if the U.S. disbanded their men's program tomorrow. It would have no impact, because even those people who come back at me when I argue this and say, well, look at the television ratings in the U.S. Look at the amount of ticket sales of people from the U.S. for the men's tournaments. You know what that is? That's Mexican national team fans. That's fans of Central American countries. Mm-hmm. There are not many U.S. men's national team fans anymore that are watching on television. Well, in the U.S. and qualified for the last major FIFA tournament. So their revenue from that was zero. $0, €0, zero, whatever denomination you want to use. Whereas my argument is, even though we saw England get into this tournament and record TV numbers there, record TV numbers in France, record TV numbers in Italy, the Women's World Cup as a commercial property may not even exist for FIFA to make whatever smaller percentage of the men's pie they make, if not for the U.S. women, and if not for the interest in the United States. So if that's generating $500 million in revenue, I'd say like $350 million of that is due directly to the U.S. women's national team. The Men's World Cup is supposedly generating $4 billion in revenue. Zero of that is due to the U.S. men. Yet the U.S. soccer now wants to turn around and make the argument that because that's $4 billion in revenue and this is $500 million, that's why the bonuses are structured the way they are.
Now, the timing of this is ideal in some ways for change to happen. I agree with you, Kartik. I think hardly anything will change. USSF will try the cosmetic approach and try to basically figure out a way to get through the rest of this year and then hope that everyone forgets about it and moves on to another topic. But the thing is that the timing of this is interesting because we have the new TV deal coming up soon, which, as a lot of our listeners know, the TV deal in the United States is packaged by some, Soccer United Marketing, and that TV deal where they shop it around to, you mean ESPN, Univision, Fox, and anyone else who's interested. That TV deal, the way it works is it's a collective. It's you have the U.S. men's national team games in there, you have the U.S. women's national team games in there, and you have MLS games in there. So if you're a Fox or Univision or whoever, and you want to buy the rights to U.S. women's national team games, because you mean everyone's sky high on the U.S. women's national team right now and have been for a long time, well, you have to also then get the U.S. men's team and Major League Soccer with that. What's missing in this whole equation is the NWSL, which is the Women's League. So the Women's League gets left out of all of these negotiations and contracts, and there's no involvement at all. So you have the U.S. Women's National Team who makes U.S. Soccer this week makes an announcement that says, we're going to have a victory tour, which is great. I mean, having a victory tour, I think 4 to 5 games around the United States that are happening. And the U.S. women will be playing friendlies against, you know, Ireland and Los Angeles and other teams around the country. All that money is going straight into the pockets of, I mean, into the pockets of some in the United U.S. Soccer Federation. That money doesn't trickle down to the NWSL. So I guess where we're heading, Kartik, is that with the next TV deal, it's probably very likely it's going to be the same type of deal. Some's going to go ahead and broker the deal with the U.S. Men's National Team and Major League Soccer, and then the U.S. Women's National Team combined into there. Is there any benefit at this stage with the growth of the U.S. Women's National Team and the amount of revenue that they generate and the amount of interest that they generate? Is breaking that off and figuring out a way, okay, what if we actually split it and had the U.S. Women's National Team coupled with NWSL and had a separate TV deal for that, and then a separate TV deal for, I mean, U.S. Men's National Team, and then a separate TV deal for Major League Soccer. Are there any benefits to that to the women's game, and are there any benefits of that to just general business?
I believe so. I mean, I believe the U.S. women, and they've articulated it, some of them have a major grievance against Soccer United Marketing, that the money they're earning, the interest they've generated, does not only not go back to their to them for equal play. It doesn't go back into the women's game at all. It doesn't even go into the U.S. men's national team. It doesn't go back into the federation. It goes into Major League Soccer. I think this is a very valid point. De-linking would be important. Now, if you de-link, I think it would be nice to see if NWSL could be thrown into the same media deal as the U.S. Women's National Team, because that would give a carrot and an incentive to watch and for broadcasters to present NWSL. This is the same thing they did with the U.S. Men's National Team rights at a time, for those who are newer to the sport, between 2002 and 2010, when there was very little interest in Major League Soccer, and the U.S. Men's National Team was getting better TV ratings than they are now. And there was more interest in that team coming off of the 2002 World Cup, where they made the quarterfinals. And quite frankly, the 2006 World Cup didn't go so well for the U.S., but that was kind of a blip in what was generally a good era for the U.S., right? They won the Hex, record point total of 22 points in 2005. The 2010 qualifying cycle, they won the Hex. Again, there was no question of qualifying for these World Cups. They won, finished ahead of Mexico in all this qualifying. Got to the finals of the Confederations Cup in 2009, beat Spain, who became the world champions a year later in that tournament. So there was an era where the MLS profited off of the success of the U.S. men. You could argue now it would be different. Although I still think the U.S. men owed a lot of residual money for all of that time, in my opinion. But I think de-linking would be good, but then keeping NWSL packaged with the U.S. women would be nice. And then in terms of the MLS-U.S. men split, if you continue to link those packages, I would like to see some sort of understanding that between 2002 and 2010, or actually I would go 2002 all the way to 2014, the U.S. men were carrying MLS, and MLS on the open market may not have been able to get their own television package. This is a point I always made when I worked with the NASL and worked with the Fort Lauderdale Strikers, that MLS, you know, people would say, well, why can't you NASL get a better TV deal than BN or CBS or One World Sports we were on for a while, 11 Sports we were on for a little bit? Well, because we don't have the advantage of linking our package with the U.S. men's national team. Mm-hmm. Don't think the broadcasters are paying for or jumping on because they want to show MLS. They were jumping on because they wanted the U.S. men's and women's national team rights. That was the reality. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of dishonesty in all of this. And when U.S. soccer goes to a fallback position, Chris, where they're trying to push back against equal pay or any sort of arguments made by critics by citing revenue numbers, their revenue numbers in itself are dishonest. So, and there are members of the media who just dropped the argument there. I'm glad the Wall Street Journal went a step beyond and kind of flushed this thing out and saw the women were generating more revenue, which was something, by the way, many of us, you know, I'll mention some folks on Twitter, Soccer Heretic, Chris Kessel, who's a great leader in this U.S. Soccer Federation. If things had been a little different, he might be the vice president of the U.S. Soccer Federation. A number of us pointed out, look, they're telling us there's more revenue from the men's side, there's more interest, but following the game and the federation as closely as we do, we're thinking since 2015 or 2016, it hasn't been the case. the women have generated more revenue. They've generated similar TV numbers. We just don't have empirical evidence. Well, thankfully, there was a newspaper that was enterprising enough to keep going and dig through the lack of transparency from U.S. Soccer. Yeah. And you know, there is public records. There are a nonprofit. So, you know, using that also, and found that the revenue was, you know, fairly equal but slightly higher for the U.S. women. So if anything, there should be a 50-50 split. Current 100-38 ratio, which is what we have.
And that's the thing, too, with the Sun TV deal that was done several years ago and will be being negotiated soon for the next round of rights, which I think expire, I think, 2022, I believe, or 2022 or 2021. That is a black box. There's no transparency there. We don't know all of that revenue that comes in. I mean, that some pays... Someone receives for these rights. How much of that split is for the women's game, men's game, and then the MLS, and then in terms of where that revenue, where that goes?
Well, we kind of now know how much goes to the federation because due to the lawsuit that Relevant Sports has filed over the denial of the Ecuadorian league game, and of course we've talked about that on a previous podcast, right. We see how much money some has given to, based on the evidence in their initial filing, some has given to the U.S. Soccer Federation. And from my vantage point, again, you can argue anything. You could argue the entire value of the package is MLS. No one would care about the national teams if not for MLS. I think that that's a ridiculous argument. There are probably MLS fans who argue that. But based on that relevant case and the way I historically have looked at this thing, U.S. soccer, and that means both the men's and women's national team, are being shortchanged money by Soccer United Marketing, $30 million a year when you consider the Fox, ESPN combined English language package, and then the Univision Spanish language package. All those two packages are over the what would have been an 8-year contract are about 650 to 700 million. So if you're saying 30 million a year over 8 years, that's 240 million. That means only about a third of that money is going back to the federation, which also means two-thirds of it is staying in MLS. Now what the split is between the men and the women once it gets to the federation, we don't know. I wouldn't be shocked if the men are taking the vast majority of that. That seems to be par for the course here. Yeah. But regardless of that, it seems like MLS is the great profiteer off of all of this. Well, this entire thing, they're making more money than anyone.
Yeah.
And the women's national team, the men's national team is getting screwed, and the women's national team is really getting screwed.
Absolutely. And that's the thing, too. Again, for some listeners who may not know, is Soccer United Marketing is the marketing arm of Major League Soccer. And it's a marketing company that partners with USSF, and is out there, and actually even with the Mexican national team too.
Correct.
So we go back to what you said earlier, much earlier, about in terms of attendances and how the revenues coming in for soccer in the United States. A lot of that is from Mexican fans for Mexican friendlies or competitive games. But Soccer United Marketing represents the Mexican Federation as well as the United States Federation, and of course Major League Soccer, but does not represent NWSL, which is the redheaded stepchild, really, in all of this, which has been left out. And that future of that league has been on the chopping block for a long time. Hopefully, with this U.S. Women's National Team winning the World Cup, that will help that league in some way.
In fairness, I'll present quickly the other side of the argument, which is that NWSL and leaders in women's soccer have an objection to Soccer United Marketing, and some for all the reasons I've articulated. So they've gone it alone and developed their own media operation with the help of A&E, who are no longer partners in the league, etc. And by doing that, the pro MLS person would argue they have shortchanged their own value in the market. If they were willing to work with us, then we could increase that value. Now, the reason a lot of people around the women's game won't work with some is, one, the previous league, WPS, was marketed by some, and the league didn't survive, and there were all kinds of questions about how that was handled. And two, I think they see this situation with the women's national team and money being lobbed off and put in MLS, and they'd rather be sure they can keep whatever money they revenue they generate in the women's game. Now it is possible, you could argue, the MLS proponent would argue that they would generate that much more revenue because of Soccer United Market's prowess and these relationships with Mexico and all these sponsors and et cetera, that they would that even if some of the money was going into MLS, they would still keep more money in the women's game. Mm-hmm. Who knows? I tend to think that women's soccer has been smart to try and not work with some, given all the realities. But there were people who would argue the opposite, that their financial problems, their revenue problems are down to not working with some. That's what some MLS proponents would argue.
Yeah, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. All right, Kartik, let's move on to the Men's Gold Cup final, U.S. against Mexico. And this one, just my two cents on this one, too, is that John Strong and Stu Holden, you know, fine on the commentary. They've worked together for a long time. No problems there. The Fox Soccer Tonight, I think it is, or whatever the name of the late-night program is. The one thing from this is to me at least, is that I mean, Landon Donovan's still got it. He's still got some great analysis and comments to give and to share. And he's definitely missed from the World Cup coverage. Because if you remember, for the 2018 World Cup, he was on the list of one of the co-commentators. He was going to be probably the main co-commentator or one of the biggest ones there. And he dropped out. And then, you mean, the rest is history. But the one thing I have to say, though, is that he looks really bad on camera. You mean, he looks scruffy. It looks like he was out all night partying. You mean, just like he did not look very presentable. But in terms of what he was offering, in terms of his analysis, that was good. The rest of the crew, well, actually, the rest of the crew. Let me just add one more thing. The rest of the crew were okay. The one thing that came out of this, and I missed this, but some of the our listeners on Twitter messaged us with this message, is that post-match, after the U.S.-Mexico game, Fernando Fiore, who in this tournament in Fox Soccer Tonight was taking more of the soccer expert stance rather than to appear like a clown, which I prefer. He has a lot of soccer knowledge, and he can add a lot to the conversations. But post-match, he was the only one that was critical of this U.S. team. Everyone else was kind of like, you know, Mexico was great and U.S. was underwhelming, but Fernando Fiore was really the only one that came down hard and said, okay, I was really disappointed with the way that the U.S. played in this game. How about you, Kartik? Did you catch any of the analysis, or did you watch it on Univision?
I watched it on Univision, so I didn't catch any of this. And so Univision's broadcast was fine. I think the problem with watching Univision is they're very pro-Mexico, even with Chelo on there. My two cents is that I think the U.S. is and the U.S. men's national team fan is impossible to deal with and communicate with and rationalize with. So I was actually having a conversation with former co-host of the show, Matt Lickstadter, the other day about this, and he and I will be on the Yanks Are Coming podcast, a little shameless plug, later this week to discuss this. But the U.S. men's national team fan seems to be so scarred by not qualifying for the last World Cup, that they, you know, they're one extreme or the other. The team is really good and got it was because of Bruce Arena, and we have all the Pulisic and all these great players, McKinney, Adams. We would be able to compete with France, Germany, and Spain one day, and then the next day it's like, you know, the coaching is terrible and we're awful, and there's no in between. There's no rational discussion. There's no understanding of a long term, especially. Actually, having not qualified for the World Cup, long-term goals. I actually think the U.S. played better in this match. Now, let me backtrack. I haven't watched any of the Gold Cup prior to this, just highlights. So it was exclusively focused on the Women's World Cup, as we've discussed on previous shows. The men, I thought, played much better, especially in the first half, than they generally do against Mexico, even when they've beaten Mexico. And what I attribute that to is Berhalter having a clear style, a clear tactical setup, a clear identity he's trying to impart in this side, which is very different than the other coaches. I think Bob Bradley was a good coach, but he was also a pragmatic manager that set up differently in each match based on opposition. I think Klinsmann just had no clue about tactics, and I think Arena also had no clue about tactics, but was a man manager, you know, motivator type. Berhalter seems to be the opposite. He has a lot of the crew played the same way. They would play the same way in every game when I went back and watched film of them after Berhalter got the job. There's a style he's trying to impart. The problem is, Chris, the U.S. isn't good enough to play that style, right? They don't have the players in midfield and out in wide areas that can play that ball possession style. What Berhalter did with the crew was sign a ton of foreign players that, you know, the Federico Higuaín's and the Ola Camaras and the Justin Mirams, etc., Jonathan Mensah's that allowed him to play that style and play it well with Columbus. There were Americans in that team, don't get me wrong, but they were, you know, supplementary parts in a lot of cases, with the exception of really Will Trapp. So what I think we see is a clear tactical stylistic setup, but a U.S. A set of American players not good enough to implement it. And once you have to go to your bench and make substitutions, once Tata Martino, you know, made a tactical change, the U.S. is unable to counter it. There are people saying, well, it's because Berhalter's a terrible manager. I don't think that's the case at all. I think it's because the U.S. just don't have good players. And two of the players he would have relied on, Dwayne Holmes from Derby, Tyler Adams from Leipzig, got hurt right before the tournament. So I'm actually cutting the U.S. men a lot more slack and the coach a lot more slack than people might expect given my record of criticism of the U.S. men. But I thought it was a pretty acceptable performance. I don't think that anyone in their right mind would have thought the U.S. should have beaten Mexico, again, unless they're being delusional. And they got beat. They got beat by a better team, but they tried to play football, which is something that the U.S. doesn't normally do against Mexico, even when they were beating Mexico. They rely on set pieces and counterattacks. So my question, Chris, is did Fox note this, or Landon Donovan played in many of those games where the U.S. would just set up deep and he would score a goal on a counterattack, but they would look very cynical in the process and winning 2-0. Was this talked about on Fox, or did they take this game in a vacuum?
I missed it. I don't know. So it's probably in a vacuum, and probably Fernando Fiore was probably one of the few people that kind of made some pointed remarks, as well as maybe Landon. But the issue is, too, is you get Moidu, Landon Donovan, and Kobe Jones, who are all former U.S. men's national team players who have really close relationships with a lot of still the players on the team, probably know Greg Berhalter pretty well, but, you mean, probably calling each other on the phone and having a really old school boys kind of club in terms of that. So they're not
also share agents, share sponsors, yeah, et cetera.
Right, exactly. Team WAS or whatever it may be. But yeah, so that's lacking, you mean, big time, as far as having somebody like an American equivalent of a Roy Keane, who says, okay, he just calls it the way he sees it and says, okay, this is actually, in that first half, was a very spirited, very energetic performance from the U.S. men's national team. In the second half, it was pretty pathetic, I thought, personally, Kartik. I timed it. There was a spell in that game, I don't know if it was like from the 65th minute onwards or around about then, where there was 8 minutes where the U.S. could not make two consecutive passes. It was one pass, missed, lose the ball. It kept on losing possession. And I'm like, this, even the basics of, I mean, keeping ball possession, they could not do. And Mexico was running rings around them. Mexico was missing a lot of their star players, Chucky Lozano, Carlos Vela, Hector Herrera, Chicharito, etc. So this wasn't even a full-strength Mexican side. I will agree with you, Kartik, in terms of the depth of this squad is lacking in terms of quality levels. But my question to you is, is Berhalter doing the same things with his team that Klinsmann did, looking overseas, looking for players that maybe have connections to, American grandfathers or things like that, to try to figure out a way to just really strengthen the squad, because it needs strengthening? Maybe in four to 8 years, this team will actually be really good in terms of these younger players, but right now it's an uphill battle. Right, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe.
I think I'm not sure if he's looking overseas the way Klinsmann. Well, you and I both need to give Thomas Rongen credit for that. It was Rongen's initiative under the direction of Bob Bradley, and then Bradley gets fired after Rangan begins scouting, and then Thomas will tell you personally that Klinsmann took a lot of credit for Rangan's work, for his own work, Thomas's work, which was initiated by Bradley, who obviously Thomas, you know, had coached with and knew pretty well. But is Berhalter doing that? Well, Tyler Boyd certainly fits that description of a guy that was playing in Europe that most American fans had never heard of before. I mean, I had seen him on vaguely in some match reports. Oh, there's this guy who's eligible to play for the U.S. but has been capped by New Zealand, playing in Portugal. Okay, well, that's nice. But it turns out Berhalter somehow convinced him. I think convinced him by telling him he would call him up for the Gold Cup, which he did, right?
Yeah.
Because he played in the Gold Cup without ever having been capped before, without anyone ever having seen him, unless you're a fan of Portuguese lower division soccer. Or I guess he played in Turkey this past year in the first division on loan. But his contract with the Diamaras. And then Dwayne Holmes, who's a player, raised in England, a player I've tracked for a number of years because I follow lower division English championship in League One football, a guy that I knew was eligible to play for the U.S., but that I never quite frankly thought would get called into the U.S. team. Berhalter calls him in, is impressed by him, and selects him for the Gold Cup, but he gets injured. So I think he may not be going the direct German-American route of Klinsmann, but it seems he's going to Europe. And the key thing here, Chris, for our listeners to realize is it's because of style. Berhalter, now you could argue, I've just given you a great defense of him a minute ago. You could argue maybe we need a more pragmatic manager because we don't have good players, right? We don't have guys who can trap the ball and string right together two passes consistently and guys who can play the possession-based football that Berhalter clearly wants to play. Possession-based attacking football that's based around really good wide play and an influential central midfield player. Maybe we just don't have the players to do that. He doesn't seem to be willing to change his style in order to accommodate the real lack of talent he has. So you have guys who just aren't capable of playing that kind of high-tempo, high-pressing, passing style, which has a lot of the elements of Dutch football, because Berhalter spent most of his career – I don't know if our listeners realize this. Yes, he finished his career in MLS, but he spent the vast majority of his career in Holland. Played a few years in England, was in the Premier League for a season or two, and played a few years in Germany, but really has a lot of Dutch influence in his thinking, and you realize that when you see interviews with him. Playing that kind of Dutch style, the U.S. just doesn't have the players, and I think your point is very well taken. After about minute 65, when he's having to sub guys out and players are tired, and the U.S.'s superiority in the first half is not rewarded with a goal, even against the Mexican side, missing a lot of players. They still had Guardado. They still had Jimenez, who had a great season this past year at Wolves. They just weren't able to handle it. I mean, they just weren't good enough.
Yeah. All right, and then before we move on, Kartik, my match of the week this past week, just real quickly, was Africa Cup of Nations. I watched Nigeria against Cameroon, just a back-and-forth game, goals galore. Really enjoyed watching this one and watched this one on beIN Sports. A lot of former Premier League stars on display, as well as some up-and-coming talent that could be moving to the European leagues in the near future. It was interesting, though, watching this game, and actually at halftime and before and after, is that beIN Sports now has basically a new tagline. So, and they mentioned this on air, I think it was Jeremy St. Louis mentioned it on air too, but even in the promos before and after the games, they're now describing themselves as the world's largest sports network. So while that is true, beIN Sports is probably, most definitely the world's largest sports network. That's not much of a selling point, though. That's like saying that Walmart, having a big sign outside the Walmart store saying this is the world's largest department chain. That does not... It doesn't make me feel good. There's no benefits to me. So it looks like it's kind of beIN Sports saying, okay, hey, let's come up with this tagline and let's focus on that. And maybe that'll impress the DirecTV or the Comcast people, where they go like, ooh, wow, I didn't realize they're the world's largest sports network. Maybe I should have them on my programming, which is not happening anytime soon. Yeah, I just thought that was really a little bit surreal there. And right, Kartik, let's move on to our TV streaming news.
Yeah, some big news we reported earlier this week at World Soccer Talk. NBC has made big changes to NBC Sports Gold, their Premier League packages. It's packages, plural now. And in summary, they've got a lower and cheaper package now that will be only $39.99 for the season. However, you can only stream matches on that, and you have to stream them live in real time, right? There's no on-demand feature. There's no bumper programming. And that's just called NBC Sports Premier League Pass. The NBC Sports Gold Premier League package that we've been which is also called Premier League Pass, which we've been accustomed to the last two seasons, costing $50 or $49.99, now has been bumped up to $64.99, and will have all that bumper programming in addition to on-demand watching the match. So basically, Chris, NBC Sports has increased the price of the actual package that I think most people are going to want. If you get the cheaper package, you can only watch the games between – and those matches are all basically 10 a.m. Eastern time kickoffs at that time, while they have other matches airing on their networks.
Yeah, this is it's a huge mess. I mean, even down to the naming conventions that they're using. So so just to clarify, that the cheaper version, which is the $30 one a year, is Premier League Match Day Pass, and well, actually that's $40 a season. I'm sorry. And that, like you said too, that's only live games that are on that there are non televised live games, and then it's a mess. It's a huge mess. At the end of the day, for me personally, this doesn't satisfy anyone. So if somebody wants to say, hey, I want to cut the cord, I want to watch all the Premier League matches, and I want to watch them live, and I want to watch them on demand, this does not provide that. On the opposite side, if you're a TV subscriber and you subscribe to NBCSN either through your Comcast or your satellite company, and you're like, I want to watch all the games. I want to have access to all the games. Well, you're going to get the ones on television. And then if you want to get the streaming ones, you have to pay extra on top of what you're already paying your cable or satellite provider. It's just a mess. It seems to be a really misguided attempt by NBC Sports to try to figure out a way to compromise, because they're a TV network. They are owned by Comcast. They want to make sure that TV subscriptions stay the same. They don't want people leaving in droves to go ahead and go cord cutting, even though that's happening already. So they're trying to figure out a way in the middle to go ahead and provide these games. The big change for 2019 to the 2020 season is that they have a restriction on in terms of, like, for example, if you want to subscribe and watch the games that were through this NBC Sports Gold Premier League Pass, the games that were on television, but you want to watch them later in the day through this Premier League Pass, you have to wait until 9 p.m. on that match day to be able to access those. So that which is absolutely insane, because if you're a Premier League soccer fan or fan of a Premier League club, and maybe on a Saturday morning you're going to AYSO or you slept in late, whatever, you miss your game, you have to wait until 9 o'clock that night to go ahead and actually be able to watch that game. And by that point, it's essentially the game's over. It's meaningless. You know what the score is. You've seen the highlights package. You've seen everything you want to see. But anyway, we go into a lot more detail on this one at worldsoccertalk.com. That goes into a lot of detail, a lot more analysis about each of these different packages, what they offer, pros and cons of each, and so certainly check that out. Now Kartik, one thing real fast too is that my solution would be to go ahead and figure out a way, whether NBC would be up for this or not, is put together a package like DAZN is doing in Canada. So for the 2019-2020 season that starts in August, just in less than 30 days, DAZN is the exclusive provider of the Premier League in Canada. And what they're offering is for $15 US dollars a month, if you're in Canada, $15 US dollars, you will have access to every single Premier League match, both live and on demand. And that's $15 per month. You can sign up for the entire season. I think it's like, I don't know, $150 or something like that. And once you figure out the cost of that, yes, it's a lot more expensive than Premier League Pass, But I would much prefer to go to that model. To me, the issues I have with NBC Sports Gold and the Premier League Pass have nothing to do with the dollar amount, the price of that. It's what they're offering, which is a really crippled, handicapped kind of streaming package that does not provide you what you get. And that's the thing, too. I think when we look at ESPN Plus, we look at the price point that they offer, $4.99 a month, and all the content that they provide. But if you multiply that out by 12, I mean, you're paying just about the same amount that you'd be paying for the Premier League Pass. The Premier League Pass feels like it's more expensive because you have to pay that lump sum up front. But to me, personally, I would prefer to have a DAZN model where I'm willing to pay extra to have access to every single game. And for those people who want to watch the games on television, they can continue to do so. And if you want to subscribe to a streaming service that has everything on demand and live, I would personally go to that and I'd pay whatever that amount of money is. And NBC would be making, I'm sure, tons of money that way, rather than a compromised NBC Sports Gold where it makes no one happy. All right, Kartik, let's move on to the next news item, and that is that ESPN and Univision have acquired the U.S. rights to the inaugural Leagues Cup. Coverage will be across ESPN and ESPN Plus in the English language, as well as across the Univision networks in Spanish language. So the Leagues Cup is a new tournament that's been set up. It's going to start this summer, featuring some of the best teams from Liga MX and some of the teams from Major League Soccer in a competition. ESPN Plus will stream three quarterfinal matches, and ESPN will televise one match in the quarterfinal round. ESPN2 will televise the two semifinal matches on Wednesday, August 20th, and then the final on September 18th. All right, Kartik, this is some big news from ESPN.
Yeah, so ESPN and the NWSL have announced an agreement to televise 14 league matches. I think I said 13 earlier in the show. It's actually 14. During the 2019 season, 8 matches will air on ESPN News, and the remaining 6, including both semifinals and the championship, will air on ESPN2. By the way, NWSL has one-off semifinal matches, unlike MLS, or unlike what MLS has had in the past. So the higher seed hosts, and it's one match. So 3 postseason games total in NWSL, they'll all be on ESPN.
And last but not least, this is interesting. A source has told me that MLS are working hard on having all of the commentators in-house under the next TV deal. So currently, if you're watching Major League Soccer games, you mean whether it's through ESPN, Fox, Univision, as well as ESPN Plus, I mean, those commentators are working for, you know, many, many different companies. But what MLS is looking to do for the next TV deal is have all of those commentators brought in-house. And what this model reminds me of a lot is how the Premier League does their broadcasts, where they have a company, which is IMG, and previously was TWI, but they have all of those commentators commentating the games for the world feed based out of that operation. Now, what it provides or may provide Major League Soccer is, if they go ahead and do this, is quality control. They can make sure that all of the commentators that are working within MLS in-house are having the highest level of quality across the entire league, no matter what games they're commentating on. It also gives them more control over messaging, over making sure that everyone's speaking from the same hymn sheet, so to speak, and in some ways can control, you mean, who is going off message and kind of rein them in a little bit. And the third of all, I'm sure there's got to be some cost cutting, some benefits from that too, from the business point of view. And what's your take, Kartik? Any advantages or disadvantages you see here in terms of having Major League Soccer possibly bringing in all of their commentators in-house?
Well, it's what the Premier League does, as you mentioned. It's what USL also does. And I guess there is quality control and consistency in broadcasts and consistency in presentation. There's also singing from the same hymn sheet, which is propaganda, really. And cutting out any sort of dissenting opinions about the quality of play, quality of pitches, quality of fans. You know, if there is some issue with fan behavior, it's not brought up, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and as an example of that too, so speaking to a commentator off the record, well, actually, I mean, kind of one of my sources, who worked for the commentating on USL broadcast for USL games, is that they were told not to mention that the USL is a developmental league. That was frowned upon. That was not. There was a phrase never to be used. And if they did use it, they got in trouble. And the other thing too, that they weren't allowed to talk about any other league, so they weren't allowed to even mention the words NASL. And that's something too. So from an instance like this with Major League Soccer, this is an opportunity to really control what they're saying. And at the end of the day, to me, I mean, as a soccer fan, this is a huge disadvantage in terms of potentially, is that you take out the heart and soul of the commentator or the co-commentator. Those people, one of the main reasons we love those people, so whether it's Gary Birtles or Stu Holden or Taylor Twellman or whoever it is you get to know the character, you get to know the person, you get to know what they like and they don't like, and you have a connection with those people. But if you go ahead and sanitize it and kind of say, okay, here's the things you can't talk about, here's the things you have to mention, this is the way things work, and if you go off message, you get a slap on the wrist, you mean two slaps on the wrist, you're out of there type of thing, it takes away the heart and soul of the commentator and then the co-commentator. And that's one of the things I love about, no matter who it is, I don't know, Tony Jones or whoever it is from around the world, is that I feel I know that person, I know that voice. If we met in a pub or something like that, I could have a conversation with that person talking about, you mean, all the great matches that he or she commentated on, and in certain things he or she likes and things like that. So that's my concern, is that this could be a disadvantage where it sterilizes Major League Soccer games in the future, where it takes the heart and soul out of the league, out of the commentating, I'm sure many of us can. That many of us like in terms of that. All right, let's move on to TV ratings. Kartik, we won't go into all of them. We do have all of them at worldsoccertalk.com on the homepage. But the big ones, let's just go through the big ones, really. It's the Women's World Cup final. It was 15.87 million for the USA against Netherlands on Fox and Telemundo. This was a 43% drop from the last World Cup. And the last Women's World Cup in 2015. Part of the reason is the time zone, for sure. That's certainly one of the reasons. We had just a message that just came in a minute ago from one of our listeners, and that was from Rob Flink. And he says, you guys seem to attribute the lower ratings to the different time zone for the World Cup. Do you think it has to do at all to the political side show stuff, or political side show stuff? I agree with the women's team, but obviously not everyone else.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'd actually thought that in the back of my mind. I've been echoing the same thing. Oh, it's because it's in the morning. It was at 11 a.m. Eastern time, 8 a.m. Pacific versus 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific for the final in Canada. But at the same time, we deal with television ratings regularly in this sport and realize Premier League games that kick off around that time tend to get more viewers than MLS games that kick off later. Now, obviously, there's a difference in level of competition in the minds of most people, but still, yeah, I had that in the back of my mind. I agree with the women's team. I identify myself with Megan Rapinoe's political views and her statements, but I think that there were certainly some conservatives and Trump supporters who were turned off the U.S. women's national team because of Rapinoe and Allie Krieger and others and didn't watch. I think that that's, you know, we would be we're being dishonest if we don't admit that. We're being honest with ourselves.
Well, I don't think it had an impact. Me personally, I think it's one of those things that actually, if anything, it probably attracted more people to watch the games because of all the outrage to tune in and see what would happen. I mean, does Megan Rapinoe, you mean, do some type of goal celebration that, I don't know, F you Trump or whatever it may be. But I think in terms of the time zone, it did have an impact. And I think the reason why is that on a Sunday morning, 11 o'clock Eastern time kickoff, 8 a.m. Eastern time kickoff, a lot of people are in church, especially in the United States with, you mean this country, there's a lot of church-going people. The timing of this game, for the mainstream audience, for the hardcores, they would have said, okay, forget church this morning, I'm going to watch this game live.
It was perfect time for the hardcores, for us.
yeah, for sure. But for the mainstream audience, I think this was not a optimal time. The Gold Cup final had 8.7 million viewers for this one. out of that, it was 2.8 million people on FS1 and 5.9 million people on Univision. And then last but not least was the Copa America final on Telemundo, and that one had 2.7 million people watching that one. So some big numbers. Altogether, Kartik, on Sunday, on Soccer Sunday, for the Women's World Cup final, the Gold Cup final, and the Copa America final, and the MLS game between Atlanta and New York Red Bulls, the collective viewing audience was 29.5 million people. So for all those people who think that soccer hasn't made it in the United States, yes, it took four games to get a huge number, but still, regardless, that is a massive number for viewership on a Sunday for soccer. Moving on to listener mailbag, JP says, I just saw the Univision owners are exploring a sale. What, if any, impact do you think that could have on their coverage in the future for soccer? They were the saving grace for the UEFA Champions League group stages and all of Europa League. And you guys speculate a possible destination for La Liga after 2020. Also, could new ownership start a process where Univision sees synergy with beIN, both Florida-based in the US, and buys their properties and coverage the way NBC did with the struggling Versus almost a decade ago to create NBCSN when Comcast purchased them? So some good questions there. JP, I think it's more so in terms of Univision. They're a private company exploring a sale. I don't see many changes happening if and when a sale happens. It might be whoever would acquire them would probably say, okay, let's just keep things going as they are now. Maybe there are some cost-cutting measures that could be applied, but I don't see that changing their focus. They're strong, especially in the soccer coverage side of things. I think up until the Women's World Cup final, up until the Women's World Cup in 2019, Univision had 49% of all soccer coverage viewership in the United States, regardless of language. So they're a huge player in the soccer circles. I don't see them changing that much. And your second question about whether there's a synergy with beIN Sports and looking at their properties and coverage, I think, honestly, and this goes for other soccer media companies too, is that they're just counting down the days until the contracts that beIN Sports has expire, which is going to be a year from now. So next summer, we will already know who's going to be broadcasting La Liga, and whether it's Univision picking up those rights without having to buy beIN Sports or pay for, you mean, kind of a partnership or a merger of any kind. They can just wait for those rights to expire, and at the same time then pick up those rights, and probably beIN Sports eventually goes away and says, okay, we're no longer interested in the US market now that we've lost La Liga rights. Similar to what happened with Fox Soccer Channel when they lost the rights to the Premier League, within a few months that channel was out of business. Next up is Gorilla Talk. We talked about a lot about VAR last episode, so he gets into the VAR stuff. Number one, VAR is getting more calls correct to the letter of the law while violating the spirit at times. The sacrifice for the letter of the law is the flow of the game. Until they restore the flow of the game, I'm against VAR. Number two, the goalkeeper coming off the line isn't called nearly enough. The most recent obvious example was in the Chattanooga versus Atlanta game last summer. It wasn't called in the second half when it should have been. It was called in the penalty kicks, and the goalie was so pissed he couldn't focus. Yeah, it's...
I remember that. Yeah. That was, I forget the name of the keeper, but it was a keeper we actually had in NASL, and Phil D'Amico, that's who it was, Philip D'Amico, and he was complaining about the inconsistency of that call in that Silverbacks versus Chattanooga FC match, but... Gorilla Talk's absolutely right. I remember that incident well. And actually, Miami FC ended up playing Atlanta in the next round, so I was watching that game closely.
John Average Geek says, while Major League Soccer national TV ratings are poor, is it possible that it's easier for fans to watch an MLS game or MLS team than an English fan to watch their team? So the answer to that would be yes. I mean, if you're talking about an English fan who lives in England and a fan of a Premier League club, absolutely yes, because there's far less coverage of the Premier League in the United Kingdom. If you mean a fan of the English game in America, then if it's on television, Major League Soccer is, it is harder. It is harder to follow Major League Soccer on television in the United States because on the national broadcast, those games are at sporadic times. It's not a consistent time. or day. I mean, you know, roughly there'll be games on Saturday, maybe on Spanish side. And on Sunday, it's been very random in terms of when the games are on FS1 or ESPN or ESPN2 and at what times. It's more consistent with the Premier League. Adding the NBC Sports Gold to the equation and looking at ESPN Plus and then local coverage for Major League Soccer games, depending on where you live, and out-of-market games and things like that, both sides are complicated. But from the television perspective, it's easier for a fan of the English Premier League in America to follow that league than it is to follow Major League Soccer on national television. Last but not least, and this is what I mentioned way back when in this podcast, MFT says, I watched the Gold Cup post-game for the final. Only Fernando Fiore was critical, not Landon Donovan. And I guess MFT says that Landon Donovan said that Berhalter needs time despite an 18-month search. Maybe a good topic. And a good topic indeed. We talked about that. So you can always reach us via email through web at worldsoccertalk.com as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk and our Twitter at worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can post your comments on worldsoccertalk.com. And Kartik, where can they find you on the Nick Geber Show and also on Twitter?
Yeah, so the Nick Geber Show is on Sports Byline and Sirius XM Channel 211, which is a Dan Patrick channel, and on American Forces Radio, as well as on iHeartRadio and SoundCloud. It's 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific every night. It's called Fifth Street Sports. I co-host with Nick Geber. And you can find me at Twitter at KKFLA737.
All right. So thank you for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, Spotify, Pandora, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Audioboom, Overcast, and worldsoccertalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review on iTunes. We'd greatly appreciate it. And Kartik, going into another weekend, we've got Africa Cup of Nations, quarterfinals, moving into the semifinal stages, and some Major League Soccer games, and I'm sure some other, a lot of friendlies coming up too. I know ESPN3 has a bunch of friendlies from around the world. If you're interested in that, what should they do?
Enjoy your football.